Yeah, these are just creepy. Zelka.
Are we ready?
Zelka, he hasn't been in the committee.
He hasn't been in the committee?
Yeah, this is like last week.
The Judiciary Committee will now come to order, February 5th. And today we're going to have just budget discussions, no bills. And on the agenda is the Public Defense Board Budget Overview, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission Budget Overview, and Judicial Standards Board Budget Overview. And with that, we'll start with the Public Defense Board and Mr. Kier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kevin Kier. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. And on my right is Bill Ward, the State Public Defender. Madam Chair and members, you have a handout in your packet. We're also going to put it up on the screen, hopefully, if everything works well. Talk about a little bit about our budget, the presentation, where what direction we want to go, where we're headed, hopefully. Just as a little bit of a background, a little bit of a review, we are the largest user of the court system. On the trial level, handle about 145,000 cases a year, about 1,200 appellate files opened every year, almost 4,000 supervised release, or what we used to call parole revocation hearings, a year. Public defenders provide mandated services in every courtroom in every county in the state. And the big thing is, as we're going to talk a little bit in later, is caseloads and workloads are really controlled by outside factors. Public defenders, and Madam Chair, as I know most of you know because you've been around here, is do not have the luxury, if you will, of refusing cases. The two cases that you see up there are Zubiak v. Mott and State v. Deegan are the two main cases there. At the same time, our lawyers are held to the same ethical standards as any private attorney is. I liken it, you see the picture of the potholes, and I think I've used this analogy in here before, is if the DOT doesn't have enough money to fill all the potholes on I-94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul, we just dodge those ones they can't fill. We don't have that luxury, if you will. If our folks have 25 clients sitting out in the hallway, they don't have the luxury of saying, hey, you last five or you last seven, got to go somewhere else. They cannot refuse those cases. As I said, at the same time, our lawyers are held to the same ethical standards, particularly for not only in the criminal side, but also on the collateral consequences. The most recent Supreme Court decision, Padilla versus Kentucky, dealt with immigration issues, but there is a long list of other cases dealing with things like collateral consequences, which I know that you all have talked about in here quite a bit, and our lawyers are also responsible for those. As the budget itself, you can see, 2 years ago, we came to the governor and to the legislature with a three biennium plan. And what we decided at that time, and frankly, which you all had supported, and we're very grateful for that, was a three biennium plan to get to 75% of the recommended standards, state and national standards for staffing. This really grew out of what we had as a roller coaster of budget issues. Particularly back in 2008, we lost about 15% of our staff, either through attrition, through layoffs, through early retirement, through buyouts, whatever we could do because of the funding issues that we had. That came on top of a reduction in staffing back in 2003. Which we had. And so we really had kind of a roller coaster of budget problems. We came to the governor in this body to say, listen, we didn't get in this situation overnight, and it's not going to take an overnight fix. And so we had a plan. We are here for phase two of that plan. And I want to talk a little bit about what we're asking for. One is the attorney staffing. Secondly is some support staff additions, personnel costs. As those of you who have been around here for a while know, We have to live within whatever you all appropriate. And if there are insurance increases, retirement increases, some kind of salary increases, if there's not funding for those, it comes at the expense of our personnel or lawyers.
Members, I just want to let you know in the audience that there is now a quorum present. Thank you.
And finally, a small grant increase or small increase on our grant funding for our public defense corporations. Madam Chair, as I mentioned, we are at currently that red block that you see or the red column. We are currently at about 65% of the recommended national and state standards for staffing. Over the next 2 years, we'd like to get to that 71% figure that you see on the middle right there. It would require the addition of 24 full-time equivalent attorneys in 2016 and an additional 19 full-time equivalent attorneys in 2017. We would obviously love to get to that green column, that 100%, but frankly, you all don't have the resources to do that. That would require somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 lawyers around the state. As I said, we would love to be able to get to that level. But realistically, that's not something we thought that we could come in and ask for. And we're going to talk a little bit about what the 75% figure will mean in just a little bit. So that's on our lawyer staffing. On our personnel costs, I think you heard the judiciary in here maybe last week or 10 days ago talking about an increase for their staff of about 5% a year. We are looking to fund progression increases and cost of living adjustments over the next 2 year period that average out to about that 5% as well. As you heard from the court, our folks had the same limits on their salaries over the last several years that the court has had. We went through 2010 through 2013, there were no cost of living adjustments. There was a total freeze on salaries in 2010 and 2011. On this chart that you see in here is a comparison to the Attorney General's office. As you can see, we're not terribly far behind on entry level, although it is a difference. But as you move through the system, you can see that the differences start to expand. We're not here to ask for you all to make up that difference this biennium, frankly. But what we're trying to do is give our folks some comfort, if you will, or some indication that they're going to have some kind of regular increase. Our retention is getting to the point now where we're really starting to lose our really well-trained defenders to other public agencies because we can't keep up. And one just real quick example is we had a woman earlier this year who left to go from our office in Olmsted County, defending felony cases to the city attorney's office in Rochester and got, I believe it was an $8,000 or $9,000 salary increase, and she only prosecutes misdemeanor cases. Now, I shouldn't say only, but she got about half the caseload that she had as a public defender, obviously not as difficult a cases, and got an $8,000 or $9,000 a year increase. Again, we don't believe you're going to make that all up.
Mr. Kyer, Senator Hall.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't necessarily trying to interrupt here. But, Mr. Kyer, you're comparing the public defenders with the Attorney General. Is that a good comparison, or is it different with county attorneys? That do somewhat the same, just on the other side of the aisle, if you call it that?
Mr. Chairman, we chose the Attorney General's office because it's another statewide agency that primarily made up of lawyers, some of whom do similar work, appeals. They do have some criminal work on the trial level. On the county level, our salaries are comparable in a lot of counties, but they are much less in the counties where about 70% of the caseload is. So if you look at that map and say, where are the cases? Where about 70% of the cases occur, our folks are making significantly less than the county attorneys. In those places where it's comparable, we're going to talk about this. We have a 19-step salary range, which I have not seen a salary range that's higher than that or has more steps in it. So even where we're comparable, folks are moving faster than our folks are because we don't have an automatic progression or step increase in our contract.
Senator Hall?
That answers your question.
It does with that. So tell me, in the comparison, you're talking about public defender and then those that are prosecuting. Does it give the prosecutors an advantage in a case? And if that's the case, they have an advantage because they get more money. Why is it this way?
Well,
Mr. Kyer,
I will defer to Mr. Ward. I think on the advantage case, I'll answer the second part of the question, because I've been around long enough to remember it. Is 20 years ago, when the state assumed the cost of public defense, we had a myriad of different systems, and at the time, the issue was we really wanted to have salaries comparable to Hennepin and Ramsey County, who had the only two fully staffed statewide, or I should say countywide, systems in place. Frankly, the legislature didn't buy into that argument. And so as we developed the system, we had to develop a system that was comparable to other state agencies. And as you can see from our chart, we have now started, we shouldn't say we started to fall behind, we are falling behind even on that. So on the issue of the advantage, I will say that the advantage is more in support staff, in policing. We have roughly half the support staff that some of those county attorney offices have. They obviously have the police that do their investigations. And again, I'm not suggesting that it shouldn't be that way or that they're overstaffed, but that's just the reality of it. And I don't know.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, there is an advantage as far as the increased salaries for longevity of staying in an office. The difficult problems I face and all the chiefs face is the attrition that we're having in that experience years of 4 to 10 years. And those folks are leaving. And then you basically are – not basically, you're hiring new folks, getting them trained again. And in the meantime, you're kind of pressed for how do you get prepared for cases when folks don't have the experience they need. So there is an advantage there. But if I may echo what Mr. Kyer was saying, it is a staffing level issue. And I've addressed this body in the past. When I was chief of Hennepin County, the 4th District, we had around 48,000 cases per year that we were appointed to. I had 12 investigators. Now, you think about 37 jurisdictions and police departments and the sheriffs and investigators for the county attorney's office and separate local prosecutors. I mean, 12 investigators is obscenely low compared to what we actually needed in order to do our jobs effectively.
Chair?
Senator Hall.
It seems to me whether it's a fairness issue or whether it's just unconstitutional for us to have such an imbalance there that we need to consider helping these guys out much more than they've been helped out in the past and try to bring a balance to this. So that would be at least my public record request.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Go on, Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair, on page 8, we start with the support staff. And as you can see, we're operating with roughly half of the number of support staff that our state and national standards would dictate that we have. What we're asking for in this budget request is 7 what we call sentencing advocate positions. They're really mitigation specialists, if you will, particularly helping those folks who have mental health issues, addiction issues. They're the folks that put together some of the alternative plans so that we're not, hopefully not sending a lot of these folks to prison or to long-term jail sentences, but rather trying to find, as I said, those alternatives for them. We're also requesting 12 what we're calling multifunctional positions for greater Minnesota. What we have found is a real difficulty in recruiting part-time defenders in some areas of greater Minnesota. As a number of you know, we have some longtime defenders who have been part of the 3- and 4-person law firms in the various towns around the state who are now retiring. And to ask somebody to go, for example, to Wadena, Minnesota, and hang out a shingle for $34,000 a year on the off chance that they might end up with some private business is just not realistic. So what we did was create a what we call a roving full-time defender positions. So rather than put our money into bricks and mortar, we've created a number of these positions where they are full-time. So they're operating or working and traveling on our dime rather than their private side, and they're covering multiple counties. The multifunction position would be something similar to that, where we may not have the luxury of having a paralegal or investigator or a law clerk in a particular county. But if we've got somebody that has all of those skills, they can cover a number of those counties and, again, travel so that we're making the most out of having that resource in those various districts. As I mentioned, we have 4 public defense corporations that the board administers grant funding for. Some of you are familiar with these folks. The corporations provide service in cases that otherwise would be public defender cases. We're asking for a 5% increase in their grant funding in each of the next 2-year period. Roughly, depending on the corporation, 40 to 50% of their funding comes from private sources. So, which brings us kind of the question of, here's the budget request, but why are we here? Which you all always want to know. We really are operating on kind of a partial justice system, if you will. On page 11 of the handout, you can see the 2 maps of Minnesota. On the left is the misdemeanor court or out of custody. On the right is the map for in custody cases. The yellow counties on the left-hand side are the ones where we currently don't have somebody when folks come in for first appearance on those out of custodies. On the right, or in the red, are where we're not available for in-custody arraignment. So when they come in for their first bail hearing, there's no public defender there to represent them. Frankly, that's embarrassing to us. We just do not have the bodies to do that. At 75% of the caseload standards, which we're hoping to get to by the end of next biennium, we're hoping that we're going to be able to color that map into blue or at least white so that there isn't a county, provided that the caseload warrants it and that we have some calendaring support from the court, that we're not going to have any of the red counties there. That when there are in-custody cases, we would have somebody there.
Mr. Kier, what does the white represent?
White is sometimes available.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's again, I haven't seen.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kier, if a defendant seeks a public defender due to his indigent status in a county that is depicted here as never having a defender available, what happens?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Ward.
What happens is the accused applies for a public defender. The court has the person in front of him or her, appoints the public defender, and then typically a bail setting will be made at that time without a public defender present with the accused. It will be set over for Rule 5 for a lawyer from our office to show up. In some courts, we would ask for another bail hearing because we weren't present for the first one and an argument wasn't made by counsel. By us not being there, we have no way of resolving the case. If the client sits in custody, it's a cost, obviously, to the county, but it's set over for Rule 5 for an attorney to be present with the accused.
Madam Chair, it's kind
Senator
of
Limmer.
A Muhammad comes to the mountain type of comparison. Could you ever move a defendant's venue to a different district, or does it have to be in that district?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ward.
Senator Limmer, there is one area where we have what we would call a tri-county system that's in place in western Minnesota. And in working with the district courts there, they have a single jail for three counties and a first arraignment calendar for three counties. So our lawyers go to that single facility, as do the prosecutors, or have other prosecutors handle the cases for them. Ultimately, after the first appearance, the cases are sent back then to the venue county where the crime allegedly occurred.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Having experience with the tri-county system, do you think it's time for us to consider a redrawing of a map so that we can get a better concentration of our resources rather than county by county or district by district, that we combine our resources so that we have a concentration of public defenders for a wider group of people? You get a better use of resource per case.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ward.
Senator Limmer, internally, our board and the chiefs have discussed whether we even need to stay by the same judicial district for how we manage our office. And our discussions on this issue began over a year and a half ago, and since my appointment beginning last July. I'm not so sure that we're running as efficiently as we can be by being aligned with the judicial districts as they currently exist. And as an example, members, right now, what is the 8th Judicial District, there is not a chief for the 8th District. It's now combined with the 7th and 8th for us to manage that. And Rex Tucker is managing both the 7th and 8th District. So, yes, I think it's time certainly for us internally to examine how we are delivering our client services and making sure that we're doing it in the most effective and efficient way. And as Senator, you know, we've been always open to discussions with the district court, the judicial council, is any ideas that they may have where we can do a better job. Ultimately, it's going to be a system where the venued county is going to have to agree with another county handling their case. So that's not something, you know, realistically I have any control over. But if that occurs, we'll make sure that we have the right persons, the right individuals to be there to be client-centered, making sure we're helping our clients the best we can.
First, Senator Newman and then Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Turner, I ask you a couple of questions on the budget for this matter. If you don't know the answer, that's fine. You can fill it in the blank for me later. But I'm looking, and I'm not sure if I'm reading this right, but I'm looking at page 5, Public Defense Board budget. And it looks like in 2016 they're looking for an additional $3,950,000. In fiscal year 2017, the board is looking for an additional $9,500,000. Am I reading that correctly? Page 5, Mr. Turner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm here now.
Okay. I was trying to talk until you could catch up with me.
Mr. Turner.
Am I reading that correctly that the board is looking for an additional over the current budget $3,950,000 in 2016 and $9,500,000 in 2017?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman.
Mr. Turner.
That's correct, for a total of $13,453,000.
When convenient, could you get me a percentage of increase in each of those 2 years over the current budget? Don't have to do it now. Just whenever you feel like doing the math.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Senator Newman, I'll have it by the end of the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Ward, I know that my good friend Senator Limmer was asking questions about the lines and, you know, whether that would, you know, help you all with your work. If you were to change those lines and counties agree to allow another county to do their work, would that change what you would need in order to make sure you're able to do your work as we think about the budget request that's here?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ward.
Senator Champion, it wouldn't change things. I mean, we would obviously, with the venued county, the case would go back to the venued county for resolution and for litigation. So, again, with the tri-county system, it helps us and it helps those counties be more efficient with the bench sitting in one place, the three counties bringing the accused to one jail and having a courtroom in one center for that first arraignment. Afterwards, the cases are then returned back to the venue county, and we need the bodies, obviously, to help to handle those cases for the various clients we're appointed to.
And Madam Chair,
if Mr. Champion,
thank
or
you.
Senator Champion.
It's okay, Senator. You know, I just want to make sure that I say to my colleagues around the table how important the ecosystem is when we think in terms of the court system. And as we look at the needs of the public defender, we are talking about their needs internally, but we're also talking about their availability and their ability to do their work in order to make sure they're providing the necessary support for the individuals that they serve. And so I just want us to remember that, and I know that Senator Hall and I have often talked about a variety of different things, but this is one thing where I do believe that we have to think about, you know, how do we make sure that we resource this aspect of our system, because they do represent a branch of government, right?
Mm-hmm.
They represent the judicial branch, and we want to make sure that they are fully resourced and for us to be able to do the things that we need to do on our end to empower them to do the work that they need to do. So with that being said, thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair, if I might briefly respond to that, because one of the things you don't see in this, or two things you don't see in this budget document are, one is our part-time defenders, which are mainly in greater Minnesota, put in roughly 35,000 hours a year for which they don't get paid. A lot of it is windshield time. So when you talk about concentrating in having those tri-county arraignment setups, yes, we still need the bodies for caseload, but it relieves them or potentially can relieve them of an awful lot of windshield time that they have going from courthouse to courthouse. In the 9th District, I think it was 2 years ago, the chief calculated that they had the number of miles that their defenders drove put them around the world four times.
Five times
in that year. So over 100,000 miles. So that's where it would really help or assist in a lot of that, again, is on their dime because it's taken away from their private side because they don't get paid for any additional hours over and above just their salary. So,
members,
Chair,
Mr. Kyer, I just want to say we got about six or seven minutes left.
Okay. Madam Chair, let me jump then, because you all know we've been here before in terms of some of these issues, and you've all been around. Let me just jump to page 16 of the presentation, which is, you know, we talk about state and national standards, but the state and national standards are actually relatively old and really don't take into account some of the other issues that we've had to deal with over the years. And again, I'm not here to argue that these aren't good ideas or that they shouldn't be done. But here's some of the things. The increased use of scientific evidence, touch DNA, DNA in property crimes, DNA use for old crimes, digital forensics, all of these things take time to analyze. There are additional work that the lawyers have to be doing. We've talked in this committee about 30 to 50% of people in jail have some kind of mental illness or mental health issues. That number is probably low, Madam Chair, as you well know.
Yeah, Mr. Kyer, up to 70% is what I'm finding.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. 80 to 90% of the criminal cases have some kind of issue involved with either drug addiction or drug use. Language and cultural barriers. As we become more diverse, we have language and cultural barriers that we're dealing with, or our lawyers are dealing with all the time. Federal, state, and even private decisions or funding. Increased use of security cameras. Anoka County just received a grant for a full-time officer for DWI enforcement. You might have read in the last couple of weeks where Hennepin County is now executing warrants for 200 felony-level sex offenders. Again, nobody's arguing that isn't a good idea, but now you have 200 additional felony cases that are going to be in the system that now are going to need some kind of attention. The use of audio tapes, even. takes about three times as long for a lawyer to review an audio transcript, if you will, as opposed to a written transcript. The increased severity of criminal sanctions, the collateral consequences, which I know you all have dealt with here. We have 200 collateral consequences in the state of Minnesota. That doesn't include the federal consequences, doesn't include private landlords and private employers looking for background checks or disqualifying people from employment or from housing. As I mentioned before, our lawyers are responsible for those collateral consequences as they're negotiating plea agreements or they're going to trial. Something, again, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, yeah, we had them, but not to the degree that we have them today. Finally, Madam Chair, I know we're running short of time, is on page 24. We believe we've been a good steward of public funding. 95% of the board's budget is direct service to clients. 90-plus percent of our staff provides direct service to clients. We're in the process of developing an electronic content management system where we can get that content, store it, view it all electronically from prosecutors. We're working with the prosecutors, working with the court on those issues. As Mr. Ward mentioned, we've consolidated our administration of the 7th and 8th districts. So we have our managing attorneys in those areas supervising and mentoring folks who are in both of those districts across district lines, if you will. We've expanded our trial team, which is a statewide resource for those areas. We mentioned the multifunction job class and the roving full-time defender. These are all things we're trying to do within a limited budget to try to do better at what we do, to be more efficient, and to provide better service. Finally, Madam Chair, we talk about services and value. Where do we want to end up? We want to end up with coverage at meaningful first appearances. Obviously, we want to promote the representation of clients at all the critical stages, including bail hearings. Reduce those scheduling conflicts where one lawyer covers multiple courtrooms. Again, in Hennepin County, it might be down the hall or on a different floor. You get into greater Minnesota, and now somebody's getting in the car and having to drive to another county, which obviously makes it much more difficult. And reduce delays by being better prepared. In those counties, as you saw, where we're not there for first appearance, there's no advantage for our folks to have those cases delayed, because the cases just keep coming. And so if they're not resolved, that's just that much more of a workload that our folks have going into the future. So, Madam Chair, I know we've asked some questions, but we're obviously here to answer whatever other questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kyer. Members, are there any additional questions for Mr. Kyer or Mr. Ward? If not, then thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I believe it's Nate Reitz. I hope I said that. It's either Reitz or Reitz. I don't know which one. Reitz, okay. And Jeff Edblad. And who would like to start?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Jeff Edblad, Chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I have been the county attorney representative to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission since 2003, and I have served as the commission's chair since 2007. I'm also currently serving in my sixth term as the elected Isanti County attorney, and also serve on the executive committee of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association as that group's secretary and member of the board of directors. Seated beside me is Nate Reitz, the commission's executive director, and we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present the committee with the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission budget request for the upcoming biennium. The purpose of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines is to establish rational and consistent sentencing standards that reduce sentencing disparity and ensure that sanctions imposed for felony convictions are proportional to the severity of the conviction offense and the offender's criminal history. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is a legislatively created body whose purpose is to maintain the guidelines, evaluate outcomes of changes in sentencing policy, analyze trends, and make appropriate recommendations, and provide education on sentencing law and policy. The primary considerations of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines is that of public safety. However, there are other considerations, including to promote uniformity in sentencing so that offenders who are convicted of similar types of crimes and who have similar criminal records are similarly sentenced. We also provide rationality and predictability in sentencing, also to establish proportionality in sentencing so that the severity of the sanction increases in direct proportion to an increase in the offense severity or the criminal history of the offender or a combination of both. We also espouse the principle that sentencing should be neutral with respect to the race, the gender, the social or the economic status of convicted felons, and this is a paramount cornerstone of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. The guidelines also consider the finite capacity of correctional institutional resources and recognize the fact that confinement in these correctional state resource facilities should be imposed only for those offenders who are convicted of more serious offenses or those offenders who have longer criminal histories. Equity in sentencing requires that convicted felons with similar relevant sentencing criteria receive similar sanctions, and also that convicted felons with relevant sentencing criteria substantially different from a typical case receive different sanctions. The guidelines implement uniformity by giving offenders who are convicted of similar types of crimes with similar severe criminal history records, similarly recommended sentences. The guidelines implement proportionality by increasing the severity of the recommended sanction in direct proportion to an increase in offense severity level, the convicted felon's criminal history, or both. The guidelines are predictable in that the recommended sentence in months is found on the applicable sentencing grid as provided in the back of your materials, at the intersection of the assigned offense severity level and the offender's criminal history. The gray areas of the grid reflect presumed state prison terms, while the white areas of the grid reflect a recommendation of an executed prison sentence. An offender will normally serve 2/3 of the executed prison sentence in the prison setting and will normally serve the last 1/3 of that sentence on supervised release. This is a part of a determinant sentencing structure, one that has a defined length that cannot be changed by a parole board or any other agency. This results in a fixed sentence that is known to all up front. It is known to offenders. It is known to victims. It is known to the correctional institution. And it is something that is not subject to the discretion of a parole board. Now, this is different from an indeterminate sentencing system, which existed in Minnesota up until 1980 when the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines were implemented. And under an indeterminate sentencing system, those systems are limited only by the legislative maximum penalty. Under an indeterminate sentencing system, sentencing judges had broad discretion to decide which offenders should not be sent to prison, as well as the fact that a parole board had broad discretion to grant prisoners early release if the parole board believed that this offender was not likely to commit future crimes. The Minnesota Sentencing Guideline Commission's statutory charter gives the agency a dual role, that of establishing and recommending sentencing policy, as well as providing analysis and oversight in the areas of felony sentencing practices in the state of Minnesota. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission is an 11-member body responsible for the agency's policy role. The three judicial members of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, represented in light blue on the slide, are appointed by the Chief Justice and represent all three levels of the judiciary, one spot for the Supreme Court, one spot for the Court of Appeals, the final for a district court judge. The remaining eight members of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission are gubernatorial appointees whose terms run concurrently with that of the governor. Appointments or reappointments to all of these seats, but for that of the Commissioner of Corrections, are currently pending in the governor's office. All major criminal justice stakeholders are represented through these positions. There is a spot for a public defender, a spot for an elected county attorney, a spot for the Commissioner of Corrections, a seat for a peace officer, a seat for a probation officer, and three seats are designated for members of the public, one of those three seats reserved for a crime victim who has been a victim of a felony-level offense. Our main responsibility is to maintain the guideline structure by annually modifying the sentencing guidelines as needed, and we'll describe that process next. The left column on the slide describes how the legislative process prompts a change in the guidelines, a reactive change on the part of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. When the legislative process prompts a change in the guidelines, the commission determines whether a guidelines change, for example, the initial ranking or a subsequent re-ranking of an offense, is appropriate. Those changes become effective on August 1st after the legislative session and after the Sentencing Guidelines Commission holds a public hearing on the proposed modifications. The right-hand column on the slide describes situations in which the commission is proactive and initiates changes. And these changes may come about because of stakeholder input, public comments, review of guideline practices, appellate court rulings, public comments, or other areas. Commission-initiated changes are submitted to the legislature by January 15th of each year and take effect unless the legislature intervenes. In this year's annual report submitted to the legislature last month, the commission did not propose any new changes to the guidelines for the consideration of the legislature.
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Champion.
To that point, to the testifier, you indicated that the Sentencing Commission did not recommend any changes, and if you can expound upon that, that would be important, and perhaps I should also put this question in context. We've heard a lot about drug cases and the and that the majority of those folks who end up in prison are costing us a lot of money, right? Both the court system, both, you know, in prison where we're spending $30,000 to $40,000 per person, and not to mention that we cover the cost for we as the public covers the cost of that decision for low-level drug offenders to be in prison. So can you tell me what the commission has done in order to address this issue or even to consider this issue?
Mr. Edblatt.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion. First, as it relates to low-level drug offenders, the state of Minnesota is 49 out of 50 states as to prisoners incarcerated in the state prison per capita per population. Only Maine incarcerates less people per capita in the state prison system than the state of Minnesota. In order for a Senator Champion, I'm using your term, low-level drug offender, in order for anyone to be sent to prison under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, if it is an offense that has a lower severity level, the individual has to have somewhat of a significant criminal history in order to go to prison on that. As it relates to actions that were taken by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission over the course of last year, we had a significant amount of discussion on the issue of drug offender sentencing and looking at drug offender sentencing not only from the standpoint of the sentences being imposed, but looking at it from more of a systemic approach, looking at a number of issues, including should there be a recommendation to adjust threshold amounts for controlled substances? Should there be changes made with regard to statutory maximums? Should there be changes recommended to be made as it relates to mandatory minimums, as it relates to subsequent drug offenses? What role should we take in the promulgation of increasing drug courts? And then also the discussion has to entail if there is money being saved with regard to incarceration, how can we ensure that that money is going to be going into the treatment needs of these offenders rather than going into other sources? At this point, you know, it is an issue that is under discussion. It is an issue under consideration, and we are looking at all of these options and all of these alternatives and trying to wrap our arms around a fairly complicated issue.
Madam Chair, can I
Senator Champion?
Thank you. As it pertains to the incarceration per capita, and you talked about Minnesota being 49th, did you say?
Yes, sir.
So can you tell me what the incarceration per capita is in light of drug offenses? So where do we rank when it comes to drug offenses?
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, I do not have that information, and I can, if Executive Director Reitz or maybe a staff member has that, but not being a full-time employee of the commission, I do not have that information.
Senator
Champion.
I think this
Mr. Reitz.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, we get our statistics from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. That's an agency of the Department of Justice. They compare all the states and their per capita incarceration rates. The data that they give us does not break it down by why they are in prison. It simply breaks it down by whether they're in a state prison or a local correctional facility, and that's the basis by which we say we are 49th in the nation on a state-by-state comparison.
Madam Chair,
Senator Champion,
to the testifier, then is it possible for you to give us a breakdown of the total number of folks that are in well, I don't know if you have this. Maybe I can talk to corrections about this, but the total number of people that's in prison in our prison system or correctional system and the breakdown for their offenses, like if a large percentage of them are drugs or related offenses or not. Is that something that you think I should talk to the Department of Corrections around?
Mr. Reitz?
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, with respect to who is currently in custody and why they are in custody, I would refer that question to the Department of Corrections. We can talk about sentencing trends. We get the data at the time of sentencing. So those are, I think, two different ways of looking at the same question. So depending on which way you wanted to look at it, you could consult with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission or the Department of Corrections.
And, Madam Chair, the last
Senator
question,
Champion.
Because I know that we're pressed for time, but my last question is around mandatory minimums. I know that you briefly started talking about mandatory minimums, and I want to know what the Commission's position is on mandatory minimums, because the whole reason that I think it's important for us to hear your discussion about that is because mandatory minimums also removes any discretion from the hands of a judge or any of the other individuals that's present during any sentencing in order to determine what would be the appropriate sentence, and therefore that does drive up costs, that does, you know, put more of a burden on us as taxpayers, and so I want to just understand what the Commission's position is on mandatory minimums.
Which one of you would like to answer that?
I can take the first shot at it, Madam Chair, Senator Champion. As far as an official position, we have not taken an official position as a Guidelines Commission on that issue because it is part of the overall continued discussion. We have not part and parceled out. We will take a position on this part of the drug issue. We will not take a position on this part. It's part of a work in progress. I can also say, as a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and a member of that executive committee, the issue of mandatory minimums is being discussed with regard to that organization as well.
Senator Goodman. Senator Sheeran.
Thank you. I can't read the book here, so I'm trying to follow over there. Where you're talking about your policy role reactive, and it states there that the legislature creates or amends something, right? That would increase or decrease the sentence, I'm assuming. And then as you go down, it looks like you have a promulgation changes, and then you have some public comment before the changes take effect. And that causes me to think, you know, if it's changed in law, is the public meeting about information, or I don't understand that process if the legislature has taken an action and changed statute.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Edblad.
Senator Sheeran, the process is that at the conclusion of a legislative session, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission staff compiles for the Guidelines Commission statutory changes, new offenses with statutory rankings or any changes made in statutory maximums to existing offenses. Once that data is compiled, it's brought before the Sentencing Guidelines Commission for a policy decision as to, number one, Do we need to re-rank these offenses or rank these offenses? And number two, if so, where is it ranked? We then, as a commission, will make a decision, essentially a draft decision. We will hold a public hearing every July on the proposed changes in rankings here at the Capitol. We give the public and stakeholders opportunity to show up. We do provide the notice and comment provisions. Members of the public have shown up in the past. Stakeholders have shown up in the past to comment on those proposed changes. Approximately a week later, then the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission meets at their regular July meeting and decides, considering the input that's given at the public hearing, as well as the fact that the public hearing record is held open for a period of several days to allow for written input for those who cannot attend the public hearing. Subsequent to the public hearing, when we meet a week later, we then make a final decision on rankings, re-rankings that would go into effect on August 1st of that year.
Thank you. May I continue?
Senator,
do you have
Sharon,
a few minutes?
Certainly.
I have a few questions. And what effect then does a change in the ranking have? And what effect does change in ranking have? And how does it have? Are you given direction, clear direction, when the legislature passes a statute that would lead you to some change in ranking, or should we be tracking how you change those rankings because they have implications that we may not have intended? I guess that might be the question.
Mr. Edblatt.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, would it be helpful if we put the sentencing guidelines grid up and then Executive Director Wrights could make comments with regard to the question with the grid visible?
You know, I think this may be something that I'll have to take away from the committee because it may be more complex than we want to go into at the committee hearing time now. But I'd like, maybe we can take that aside and you can explain it to me separately.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I would remind you as well that there is a copy of the grid in the materials. Yep. And if you do have specific questions that can't be addressed in the course of the time limitations today, I would certainly encourage you to contact the staff, or you can certainly reach me at the Isanti County Attorney's Office, and I would be more than happy to provide whatever input I could have with regard to my experience.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Goodwin, for your generosity. I don't know if my looking at the grid would help me understand what it is, but I'm trying to get at is if through a hearing process you change rankings, what the implications of that are, and whether or not that change is in keeping with what the intent was. So I need to understand that better. The second question I have, may I, is I know that I have sent to you a piece of legislation to be reviewed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm very grateful to have received back some analysis of what the implications of that legislation would be. It is, but for the members of the committee, a part of a bill that's been introduced related to the sex offenders issue and constitutional issues. As you know, this committee has passed, the Senate has passed legislation to reform the sex offenders program, civil commitment program at St. Peter and Moose Lake. But I added to the bill this year a proposal for dealing with future sex offenders that has to do with indeterminate sentencing. And I sent that to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission for feedback. They gave that to me. But it sounds like your process, too, here would have met and made its recommendation, its report, before you had a chance to take a look at that. Is that correct?
Mr. Rates.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, we did have an opportunity to review the bill. I believe that was prior to its introduction, if I'm not mistaken, and provide some preliminary fiscal analysis on that bill. That fiscal note has not been formally prepared yet, but our senior research analyst, Ann Wall, who is present today, did conduct the analysis on that particular request. And that is one of the functions that the staff does perform. Did you have a particular question regarding that analysis?
No. My question is not about the analysis. We'll be looking at that more as we move through the legislature. You said you had a report that came out about a month ago in relationship to the committee's policy recommendations, some of the proactive things. You said there weren't any changes, but it goes through this process and then you make a report. I am asking whether or not in that process you had a chance to discuss this recommended change in the legislature, or what did had you completed that process before I was able to get that material to you? Mr. Ace.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, we did complete, essentially the committee voted on the report in December so we could finalize it and submit it by the legislative deadline, the statutory deadline of January 15th.
Okay.
I should, if I can back up to your previous question, Senator Sharon, I would, in that report, it does talk about our activities. So that is, and I think the way the statute is designed, the legislative oversight comes in that we report to the legislature on what we had done during the previous year. For example, last year the report reflects that based upon some legislative changes to criminal sexual conduct offenses, we did re-rank one of the offenses in keeping with the what appeared to be the legislative intent, and we provided a report of that change to the legislature in our annual report.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Goodman. That is very helpful. That's what I was. I'm looking for where can I go to see how this played out after the legislature took an action, and that answers that question. Thank you.
Senator Champion. We just have a couple of minutes left. Is there before we get more questions? Do you want to wrap up your presentation and then we can take more questions? Just a couple minutes is all we have left here, so I want to find out how you want to use that time.
And my question is to the issue that they're discussing.
Okay. All right, Senator Champion.
To the testifiers, can you tell me, as I look at the commission's role in changing sentencing policy, and even when you think in terms of policy role one and policy role two, there is a provision that talks about the public being engaged. And so I would like to know what vehicle is being used to provide notice to communities around the public comment opportunity. How do you get that information out? What vehicles do you use?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Reitz.
Senator Champion, we essentially have two processes for that. One is the report in the official reporter of the state, which may not have a high degree of reading. The other is, I guess two more. One is we put it on our website, which a number of people contact, and also we have an email list that we distribute. So anybody who's interested in any sort of changes is on our email list, and we alert them to any possible changes to the sentencing guidelines, and they're welcome to participate in the public hearings.
All right. Would you you want to go ahead and tell us your most important points here that you want us to leave us with?
The legislature has also asked the Sentencing Guidelines Commission periodically to make recommendations to you as the legislature regarding criminal law, criminal procedure, and sentencing in general pursuant to Statute 244.09.
The Sentencing Guidelines Commission staff has 6 full-time employees, myself, 3 management research analysts, a management analyst who trains probation officers throughout the state on the functioning of the sentencing guidelines, and an office and administrative specialist. Our functions are analysis and oversight. So the commission sets the policy. We make sure that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission runs correctly, primarily dealing with these sentencing worksheets that every probation officer creates sentencing worksheets on every single felony. We have to work with them to make sure they understand how the guidelines are working, and then we review each and every felony sentencing worksheet to make sure that it is accurate so that the judges are operating with the correct sentencing worksheet. They have the correct information before they impose a felony sentence, which is obviously a very serious matter. We also conduct research on sentencing policy for the state of Minnesota and provide a bunch of data requests, which we'll talk about on this slide. So we review 15,000 worksheets a year. We respond to thousands of phone calls, emails every year. We train practitioners, mostly these probation officers, also attorneys. We provide 200 individualized data requests in the last year. These are individualized reports on sentencing practices throughout the state of Minnesota. Often public defenders, the group that just spoke, they often request these individualized data requests so they can better fashion their arguments on guidelines departures. This is our biennial budget request. It's a approximately $600,000 a year for the biennium. This is an increase of about 2%, which I'll get to that change in a moment. I understand the 2% change is essentially to cover the anticipated change in costs of employee compensation. As you can see, most of the budget is for personnel costs. This chart shows the change in change in our budget over the past 8 years, and then the next biennium as well. The blue bump on the current biennium reflects a special appropriation of $300,000, which I'll be talking about in a moment. But otherwise, it is a 2% increase. In a survey of the states with the most similar sentencing guidelines to the state of Minnesota, we found that our budget per capita, on a per capita basis, compares favorably with those states. We cost Minnesotans 11 cents per capita, which is in line with some of the less expensive states. You'll see Oregon is a bit of an outlier. They also have additional roles that we do not. They supervise or administer portions of the statewide drug court program in Oregon. If the commission has time, I could talk about how we spent the $300,000 that you were kind enough to appropriate to us for the new electronic worksheet system.
If you can do that in just a couple of minutes, Mr. Hayes. I think this is probably the most important piece of your presentation, so I don't want you to skip it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This project was funded primarily by a $300,000 appropriation and essentially modernized this worksheet system. So, as I said, this worksheet is a critical document because it's what the judge has in his hand or her hand. It's what all the attorneys have to say what is the presumptive sentence under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. And we review all those to make sure that there are errors, but errors can creep in, and this new system has reduced those errors significantly. One way it's done that is instead of it's eliminated transcription errors, because now the data can automatically flow from the Minnesota Court Information System, or MINSIS, directly into the worksheet without having transcription errors. It also promotes efficiency for those probation officers out in the field, so hopefully they have more time to chase after probationers keep us all safer. Because if an offender is a repeat offender and they have a prior worksheet, that data can be transferred automatically from the prior worksheet to the current worksheet that the probation officer is working on. And this innovation is that it automatically calculates the prior sentence. There are a number of modifiers, exceptions, offenses, severity levels that can go into calculating a presumptive sentence. We found that there was a high error rate, sometimes a 25% error rate in some of these worksheets, and this has reduced it quite a bit by calculating the presumptive sentence automatically. So I think that the appropriation that you authorized in the last biennium has gone to good use, and it's made the product that judges are using to sentence a more reliable and more efficiently generated product. I did have some slides on felony sentencing trends. It appears that we may not have time for that. These are highlights.
I've been told that we have about 3 minutes left, so if you want to, you can go ahead and start it.
I'll begin and stop at the chair's pleasure. So this first slide here, well, there seems to be an error with that, but the first slide was intended to show I hope it showed up on your handouts, but it shows the volume of offenders sentenced. You see that there was a peak earlier in the 2000s. It's gone down since then. Now it's starting to climb back up. Property crimes we can talk about the specific on the next slide. It shows the specific ups and downs of those of that volume over time. Again, you see in the early 2000s, there was a significant rise in drug offenses, particularly 31.9% rise, and now it started to level out. Two notable things about 2013. One is felony DWIs. That's the nice dark green there. That's gone down 18% in 1 year, which is somewhat in line with Department of Public Safety statistics showing that DWI arrests are going down as well. The other thing I would point out is that person offenses have, you know, all the other offense categories have gone up and down. Person offenses have pretty much been gradually climbing throughout the last decade or so. This is the distribution of offenders by race, and we seem to have some problems with some of these slides. But the blue is white, the red is black offenders, green is American Indian, purple is Hispanic, then Asian, and then other. So you see, what this is intended to show is that our state has gotten more diverse from 1980, 1990, 2000, and 2010, but the distribution of offenders has continued to be disproportionately non-white. Well, I would refer to the numbers that are in your handout. I believe those are accurate. For some reason, this did not transfer correctly. But overall incarceration rate is at 92.5%. The imprisonment rate, which is the lower line, is obviously going to be a much lower number. It's at 27.4%. An interesting thing about the statistic, though, is that both of those rates are slightly higher than we've seen in the past. And what we're talking
about... Mr. Rates, excuse me for a minute. I want to ask you, what is conditional confinement?
We're talking about jail, basically.
Okay.
Local jail,
thank
for
you.
The most part. So 92.5% of felons who are sentenced walk out with some sort of jail sentence or prison sentence. 92.5% is slightly higher than any number we've seen in the past. 27.4% in 2013... received a state prison sentence, and that number also is slightly higher than any number that we've seen in the past. This next slide talks about the average pronounced executed prison sentence in months. You can see that I think, roughly speaking, it used to be in the 30s and the 80s. There were some guidelines changes, and now it's in the 40s, and has, for the most part, stayed consistently in the middle 40s. With some deviations throughout the 90s and 2000s. I do have some data on departures, if the chair has time for that as well.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to, we have to be done in this room by 1:30, so hopefully, how long would this take?
As long as you, I can skip over the definitions of departures, but we can talk about overall,
okay.
I can
all right.
Until the chair says I'm out of time. It's
all right. I'll tell you when you're out of time,
okay.
Then, so go right ahead.
All right. So in 72% of the cases, the defendant receives the sentence as recommended by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. In about 23% of the cases, there's a mitigated departure that can either be a dispositional departure, so you were supposed to go to prison, but the judge didn't send you to prison, or a durational departure where you didn't go to prison for as long as the guidelines recommended. There are some aggravated departures as well. Most of those are defendants asking to go to prison for reasons that may pertain to their particular case. And a small minority of mixed departures, aggravated and mitigated mixed. Again, I'm sorry, this is a slide problem here, but the first and second column are assault in the second degree and failure to register as a predatory offender. These are offenses that we see high departure rates. Only 28% of offenders receive the presumed sentence for those two offenses. The next two offenses were in the mid-30s, 36 and 37%. Those are controlled substance in the first degree and aggravated robbery in the first degree. So I'm looking at the blue bar on the bottom. These are the people who got the presumed sentence. Burglary one with assault or a weapon and controlled substance crime in the fifth degree were also offenses for which offenders got the lowest. They got 44% of those offenders got the presumptive sentence. The final statistical slide shows dispositional and...
I'm sorry, Mr. Rates. I think we have to end now, and I really apologize. It's just that we only have an hour and a half for committee hearings now versus our 2 hours in the past.
You've been very generous.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time, and it's an important issue.
Thank
we'll
you.
Hear from you again, I'm sure, when the budget bills come up before us. Now we have the Judicial Standards Board budget overview. And we have Tom Bassley and Judge David Knutson. Senator Judge David Knutson.
Let's go. I'm going back. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Knutson. I'm a district court judge out of Dakota County. And I was appointed by Governor Dayton to be a board member of the Board of Judicial Standards. I have with me our I can't call him new really anymore, but he's been with the board for nearly 1 year, Tom Vasily. He's got a terrific background to lead the Board of Judicial Standards. He's got a long tenure in the Attorney General's office. He was formerly with the Lawyers Board of Professional Responsibility, and before that got his start in legal aid here in Minnesota. So we're very proud of what the board's done in the last year or so to increase accountability, open, and keep the board open to transparent so that people know how we operate and the basis on which we make decisions. To that end, we've done a number of things. But at this time, I'm going to have Tom Vasily go through and talk about our annual report and the work of the board and the purpose of the board.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I know we're short on time, so I'll be brief. Feel free to interrupt me with questions.
Thank you.
I'll just take you through the highlights of the annual report, and that's the separately bound pamphlet that has been distributed to you, I hope. The first page of the report shows our members. We're a 10-member board. We have an exceptional board at this time. At the present time, the board has an executive committee composed of Judge Knutson, William Warrens, a Minneapolis attorney, and Tim Gephardt, a public member. You'll see that the staff at the bottom is just two persons, an assistant and me. And so that means our budget is fairly small. We have a $456,000 annual budget. And approximately a third of that goes for attorney's fees. When we prosecute a judge, we have to hire outside counsel. That's very expensive. And one of the things we're trying to do now is to reduce those kinds of costs. On page five, there's a brief description of the Code of Judicial Conduct, which is the code that judges are subject to, as well as the rules and procedures under which we operate. And one point I want to draw your attention to is under rules and procedures, the rules of the board are established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. We don't establish them. The Supreme Court adopts them, and we enforce them. We received 108 complaints during 2013. And that number actually is low because a great many persons contact our office with a complaint, but it really is something that's not within our jurisdiction. We address judges' conduct, judges' behavior. We do not second-guess their decisions. That's for the Court of Appeals. So if someone calls our office and they express dissatisfaction with an opinion that a judge issued, we refer them appropriately, and we don't necessarily open up a file. And when we do open up a file, often the allegations that they make are really dissatisfaction with the opinion in another form. For example, on page 8, at the top, you'll see that 60 of the complaints that were actually open, these are the files that were opened, in 2013 included allegations of bias. We'll ask the complainant, well, what is the bias? Well, he was biased against me. What is your evidence? Well, he ruled against me. So that from the complainant's perspective, the fact that he lost means the judge must have been biased. So really, those are non-jurisdictional. On page 9, you'll see that the vast majority of complaints are against district court judges. 97 out of the 108, and some are against other judicial officers, such as conciliation court referees, child support magistrates, and so on. The next page, page 10, shows the dismissal reasons.
Mr. Vasily, I just want to ask you on page 8, allegations reported. Are any of these multiples, like there was more than one complaint against the same judge?
That's correct. The total adds up to more than 108 because there may be more than one allegation against a particular judge. So it's quite common, for example, to say this judge, I object to his decision, it's wrong, it's against the law, he's biased against me, he failed to follow the correct procedures. And so you get multiple checks on the data form, but it's really a complaint concerning the judge's ruling, which ends up being dismissed.
And, Mr. Vasily, does that,
Madam Chair,
does that come up with your 108 then? I mean, are there actual 108 judges, or how many judges were there that there were complaints against?
We'll receive more than one complaint a year against a judge. So the fact that there were 108 complaints might mean that maybe there were 95 judges. I'm just throwing out a number. Maybe only 90, 95 separate judges received complaints. Some judges received more than one complaint.
Thank you, Mr.
Madam
Vasily.
Chair.
Senator Hall, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vasily. Are all of these on page 8 allegations report, are they all legitimate types of complaints?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall.
Mr. Vasily.
If a complaint alleges bias, and really what the complainant means is he didn't like the decision, I don't consider that a complaint that our board should have jurisdiction over. That's for the Court of Appeals.
Good.
Thank you.
But the rest of them then would be.
Some of these are
Senator Hall.
They're really disgruntled litigants.
Right.
And they might couch their complaint in other terms, but really that's what it comes to. And the large majority of complaints that we received are from disgruntled litigants. And we advise them that if you need assistance, you need to go to an attorney, talk about going to the Court of Appeals. We can't help you. They will respond, well, I can't afford an attorney, or I've been to an attorney, they won't help, or I've been to the Court of Appeals, they ruled against me. But we're not a backup system. If the Court of Appeals doesn't work for them, we're not there as a backup. We're concerned not with judges' decisions, but with their behavior.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
So that's probably the most misunderstanding that people have about your area here, Board of Judicial Standards.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, you're absolutely correct, and it's not pleasant to know that the vast majority of complaints that come in our door are things that we don't have jurisdiction over. And I think it isn't that we don't get the word out. By the time people have we're not the first call for help. By the time someone reaches us, they've been to a number of other agencies, talked to lawyers and so on, and they're flailing out. They want someone to fix the problem. They want it fixed for free. They don't want to pay an attorney. They want a government agency to fix everything. They've been around the block. They've been to other agencies. They've been to private resources. And then they come to us.
Okay.
And it doesn't take any money to file a complaint or to call us. But unfortunately or fortunately, we don't address. A judge makes a mistake on the law. That's for the Court of Appeals to correct. There are very rare exceptions to that. I'll give you one example, and it's an example of one of the few instances in which we do get involved in decisions. On page 11, toward the bottom, the first bullet point, it shows that we issued a private admonition to a judge in a landlord-tenant case. Now, normally, if a judge ruled against the landlord or the tenant, right or wrong, we just would not have any interest in it. In this particular case, the tenant came into the courtroom, and the judge said, did you pay the rent? Tenant, no. Well, we paid the rent. We didn't pay the increase. The landlord didn't have the right to increase the rent. The judge said, the landlord can increase the rent. Judgment for landlord. No trial, no testimony, no evidence. You're out of here. So, and we asked the judge, do you have any legal rationale that would allow you to have done that? And the response essentially was no. So in cases like that in which the judge didn't exercise, it's not an exercise of discretion. The judge simply did not follow what the law, the constitutional right of every citizen requires, which is give them a trial. And if they have a trial, judge has a discretion on how to rule. But you can't say you don't get a trial.
Okay. Thank
you. So when these complaints come in, we just can't automatically assume that they're disgruntled. So we do take time. The staff takes time, and then the board, the ones that are referred to the board, we do take time to take a look at, are there any real issues other than just being disgruntled or having a decision go against you? So.
Well, that was my question. Is there are there any of those complaints that do not go before the board, or does the board hear every complaint that comes in, or does staff only make decisions on some complaints?
Madam Chair, I would say a third of the letters that come in the door and just express dissatisfaction with the judge's decision, or basically they're complaining about lawyers, social workers, police. Those I dismiss immediately, subject to review by one member of our board. The other two-thirds, they come before the board. So the board has a heavy agenda every 6 weeks because they review even complaints that don't might not appear to amount to anything. They review those. And I have to say, you have to keep an open mind. You know, you get a letter from a prisoner who's complaining that all these things happened, and often that complaint is frivolous. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes that those complaints actually turn out to amount to something. If you look on pages 10 and 11, however, there'll be some examples of the kinds of complaints we do get into. And the first one is Judge Perez, which received a lot of publicity. He was a tax court judge that was consistently late with his opinions, and worse, covered it up. And he would sign his certify with his pay request every 2 weeks that he wasn't late. And so that was a big case, very expensive to try. And it ultimately resulted in the legislature deciding not to confirm him. What happened is that after a three-judge panel heard his case, the panel found that he had engaged in misconduct. The final decision is up to the Supreme Court, but as soon as the panel made those findings, Governor Dayton recommended to the legislature that they not confirm Judge Perez. And within a day or two, the legislature acted, and the next moment, he was out of a job. The other case that got a lot of publicity involved Judge Karasoff. It's not listed here because it was listed as a 2014 case, but she's a judge, Hennepin County judge, who resided outside her district for 3 months, contrary to the Constitution. And legislators have got to comply with it. Judges have to comply with that requirement, too. So she was suspended for 6 months and did not run for reelection.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes left.
Thank you, Chair. Can I ask a question?
Hall.
On that last case where she was out of the district for a few months, do her cases continue as she was the judge, even though she was in violation of being a judge? How does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, that's an excellent question. And people were wrestling with it until the Supreme Court finally decided about 3 months ago, a case called Irby. Basically, she was sitting on cases all that time, and a criminal defendant who was convicted argued she didn't have the authority to convict me because she was out of the district. And even though by the time she convicted him, she was back in the district. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said, you know, there are consequences for violating the Constitution, but one of the consequences is not that we're going to reverse these convictions.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll just mention one more thing. As I indicated, our biggest expense, or should I say the biggest expense that we could potentially control, is hiring outside counsel. And we've made an effort in the last year or so to do more investigations upfront in-house because it's a fraction of the cost of hiring outside counsel. And we have a proposal to the legislature to increase our budget by $30,000 so that we can hire a half-time attorney to assist in doing these investigations in-house. And we think the result is going to be to save money, not cost the taxpayers more money.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
I just want to make sure I heard that correct. Is he saying $30,000 or...
Senator Correct. Hall, that's what he said.
That's all you're asking for.
Correct. We found, okay. Madam Chair, Senator Hall, we found a way to because of salary savings and other savings, we can come up with about $30,000 on our own. So with the fringe and everything and the salary, the cost would be about $60,000. We're asking the legislature to pay half that.
Wow. Okay. Any other questions, members?
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Vasily, question I had is on advisory opinions. Are they made public for the public to read as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the answer is no. And in fact, I think we wouldn't get many calls if those opinions could be disclosed. So we want a judge to feel free to contact me and ask for an opinion. And this is not an opinion on what the judge has done in the past. This is asking for advice on what the judge should do in the future. And some of these involve very, very sensitive cases. Involve, for example, judges about to pass sentence in murder cases. Some of these are extremely sensitive, and I think judges need to be assured of absolute confidentiality.
Any other questions, members?
Madam Chair, I just want to cover just briefly some Judge initiatives Knutson. That some initiatives that the board is undertaking. We've got a much more robust, enhanced website to allow public access to what we do, our rules. And Senator Limmer's question was about opinions. There's a difference between formal opinions and advisory opinions. We are issuing now, for the first time really ever in the board's history, formal opinions on issues that concern judges. And Tom could go into some of the opinions that we've issued, but to provide further guidance for the judges for how to interpret the code and how the board has been interpreting the code, and so they can conform their conduct and their behavior to how the board's interpreting certain rules in the code. We've also set up mentoring programs where we assign a mentor judge, possibly a senior judge or a judge with more experience in the district, who can come alongside the judge that we've reprimanded or admonished and help correct their behavior. And that's been a tremendous success with the judges that we've done that with. We're not just a board that's looking to find fault, but we're a board that's trying to comport the judge's behavior with the code and educate judges as well. So Tom also talked about more in-house investigation, which is saving us money. The new halftime position will help out tremendously with that. And then the next step, or the other thing we've done recently, is when we do hire outside counsel, instead of simply going to the same counsel we've used time and time again, we've gone out for bid. And we've got a number of attorneys that are willing to do work at a price that we think is reasonable. So we think we've been good stewards of the taxpayers' money and still able to adequately perform our mission and our duties.
Thank you, Judge Knutson. And, pardon me?
I was going to ask a question, Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Limmer.
Judge Knutson, when you talk about the difference between advisory opinions and formal opinions, are the formal opinions made public?
Yes, they are. They're posted on our
Judge
website.
Judge Knutson.
Madam Chair, after we get feedback from judges, from the public, whatever, then we go ahead and adopt it and post it on our website.
Madam Chair, the
Senator
reason
Limmer.
I raise the question about public record is that I occasionally get comments from the public, and it appears as though the public is kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of in the dark. They don't know process. They don't know, because of the hearings that you may have on a potential misconduct of a judge, that's behind closed doors until a finding has been arrived at. And so the public, I get the impression, is kind of in the dark. They think that something is not 100% correct because it's been hidden. And I understand why it's been hidden until there's been a finding that justifies the complaint. But the formal opinions are very important for the public to follow, so they get a glimpse of what everyone is thinking about conduct of judge, procedures of judges, and I think it's important to keep that in the forefront. We keep it in the forefront here, but just to pass on that the public is very interested in what we do as a government, and the third branch of government, judiciary, is just as the public seeks that inquiry just as much as they do on us.
Mr. Vasley?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, first let me clarify one point. Once the board has decided that a judge has committed misconduct that is not isolated and non-serious, we file a formal complaint against the judge. At that point, it's open, and the hearing is open. In fact, and we post everything on our website. Right now, we are prosecuting a judge for living outside. We allege that he is living outside his district, and if you go to our website, you'll find the complaint, his answer, and in fact, the scheduling order, which discloses where and when the hearing is going to be. That hearing was open to the public. I know that one or two members of the public attended it. So once the board has decided that the judge has committed misconduct, reasonable cause is the term, at that point the process becomes public. However, we do not disclose the raw allegations where we find no misconduct, and that's not our rule. It's the Minnesota Supreme Court's rule.
Thank you. And with that, the Judiciary Finance.
Madam Chair, one last question.
Senator.
Thank you. It won't take long. And this is directed to you. Could you tell me, Honorable Knutson, Judge Knutson, has been here many years as a legislator, a senator, and then becomes a judge. Do we direct him and talk to him as the Honorable Knutson, or is it Senator? Which is above the other?
Mr. Senator Hall, I would say
I
it's the honorable.
This was directed to
honorable Judge Senator Knutson.
Thank you. That clarifies.
Well, just for the record, we are funded by the Senate, so we defer to the Senate, of course.
A wise judge.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. And if there are no more questions, members of the Judiciary Finance Committee will meet on Tuesday, February 10th, to hear budget overviews from the Minnesota Tax Court and the Department of Corrections.
Oh, good.
Meeting is adjourned.
It took me that long to figure out.